very good Easter Saturday morning to you. My name's Libby Price. Welcome to a Country Breakfast on RN. A little later this morning, it's a right royal Sydney Easter show with a visit from Prince William and wife Catherine, Duchess of Cambridge. Life member of the Royal Agricultural Society, Neville Russell, remembers showing Princess Anne around the Royal 25 years ago.
She understood the feeding of dairy cows and all that. She said the Holstein cows were too big. She'd prefer the Windsor Jerseys much more. But we discussed breeding and artificial insemination.
As one does with a princess. We'll travel the country with our rural reporters, but before that, let's find out what's been making news this week with Tony Allen and big news with Cyclone Ita.
Well, I guess the really big news is that it could have been worse. Cyclone Ita was tipped to be up to a Category 5 hitting the coast, which could have caused massive destruction not just to crops but to towns as well and buildings and so on. But there was still a fair bit of damage. There was destruction of some sort to crops from Hope Vale on Cape York to well south of Mackay. About 90% of the state's cane farmers saw some damage, often from flooding. And the production losses were up to 30% in some areas. Banana growers were hit hard in the north. Fruit and veggie growers in the Bowen district were also hit. So this week, the Queensland Agriculture Minister, John McVeigh, announced assistance for the farmers. In 16 council areas most affected by Ita, they'll be able to access Category B disaster assistance, which involves, among other things, freight subsidies to a maximum of $5,000 and concessional loans of up to $250,000 at an interest rate of only 1.7%. The good news for some of them is that they can get the freight through because the roads have now opened. But still, about 10 million tonnes of sugarcane was flooded or flattened. Kevin Borg from Mackay Cane Growers says that in his region, many of the crops can be salvaged.
I think some of the bigger cane, some of the earlier cut cane and some of the plant cane have gone over. It will take a while to recover. Some of the smaller cane has been sprawled and probably straight to fairly bent, but it'll probably straighten up the smaller cane and keep growing.
Doesn't sound anywhere near as bad as Cyclone Yasi a couple of years ago.
No, there was damage, though, to about half the tomato crops in the Bowen region. Now, this is the area that supplies most of Australia's winter tomatoes. They had heavy rain and flooding there, but fortunately, the cyclone came only a third of the way into plantings, so there is time to replant. Bundaberg grower Peter Hockings, a bit further down the coast, says it's a bit premature to say how this is all going to affect tomato prices.
Just take a chill pill, I suppose, at the moment, and let's just wait and see what the actual results are. Bear in mind there's very large growing regions, protected cropping, so there's a lot of greenhouse-grown tomatoes around the country, not quite as susceptible to the climatic conditions as field-grown tomatoes.
Now, during Cyclone Yasi, a lot of cattle stations lost cattle, some from trees falling on them. It was quite terrible stuff for the cattle stations. This time, the cattle were pretty much left to fend for themselves when Ita came along. Daryl Paradise manages Kings Plains Station, which is about 50 kilometres southwest of Cooktown. It was right in the line of the cyclone.
We had 11.5 inches of rain. That was what we caught in the gauge, of course. But as we know, with the severe winds and one thing and another, there was a lot of rain that we never measured. We're very lucky. We had no structural damage of buildings. We have got quite a big job on our hands now. Probably 25% of our mature trees in our forest here are blowing over. A lot of timber over the roadways and a lot of problem if we're going to do a lot of fencing.
This rain has actually spread right through the southeast corner, and it's great for what they call the Anzac Day autumn break.
Yes, well, even in the southwest, even in Western Australia, they've started sowing crops earlier than usual. And in South Australia, they're sowing before the usual sowing date of Anzac Day as well. Marion Wicks is a farmer from the mid-north of South Australia. She says they've already put in crops that will feed stock, and they're now on to planting canola.
This year, we've had wonderful rains 2 weeks ahead. We ended up with 76 mils. I think the ground's lovely and moist at the moment, so we won't have any hold-ups that regard. And then afterwards, hopefully, we'll have a bit of rain and keep things moving.
Now, some controversy again with live export, this time because Andrew Wilkie wanted to go on a ship. They said yes and then changed their minds.
Yes, Mr. Wilkie is a well-known critic of the live export trade, and four times he has attempted to get it banned in federal parliament, each time the major parties have refused to support him. But he was invited by the live export industry back in January to go on a ship at some time to Indonesia to see how the cattle were treated and see how the complete supply chain from paddock to Indonesian plate worked. Well, he had a meeting this week with the live export industry and they withdrew his invitation. Mr. Wilkie says they made all sorts of excuses, including lack of room on the ship and the upcoming Indonesian election.
Well, I think they realised that it wouldn't be helpful for their cause for someone like me to see what goes on aboard the vessels, in the feedlots and in the abattoirs in Indonesia itself. I mean, I think they've got something to hide. It's as simple as that.
Well, the industry denies it's as simple as that. They say they don't have anything to hide. The industry's made wonderful progress in delivering better animal welfare. Now, what the chairman of the Australian Livestock Exporters Council, Peter Kane, has said is that they did invite Mr. Wilkie to board a ship in good faith, but only a few days later, after the invitation in January, he introduced another bill to ban the trade. We had hoped, he said, he would explain his contradictory actions and give us confidence he was genuinely interested in using the visit on a ship to further his knowledge of the trade, rather than use the visit to continue his misrepresentations. Now, they have offered Mr. Wilkie the opportunity to watch cattle being loaded for Indonesia at an Australian port, but Mr. Wilkie has rejected that offer.
One would have thought if he really wanted to know what it was like, he could go to Indonesia to have a look.
Oh, well, that's up to him.
Yeah. Now, this is quite extraordinary. The Federal Industry Minister, Ian McFarlane, really a cheer squad for the coal seam gas industry.
Coal seam gas exploration is a hugely controversial issue in regional Queensland and regional New South Wales. And in New South Wales, the government has a moratorium on CSG exploration and is really quite restrictive of it. In Queensland, the government has negotiated more with the industry and there's a lot more CSG going on. Well, this week, the Australian Petroleum Producers and Exploration Association, or APEA, put out a report, obviously designed to encourage more investment in CSG. It said more than 40,000 people are now employed in the coal seam gas sector and $70 billion worth of projects are under construction. So that is a hell of a lot of stuff going on. Mr. McFarlane says, and he's a Queenslander, he used to be a farmer, he now says the coal seam gas industry has turned around the fortunes of Queensland. He says he's been in agribusiness and politics for 30 years, and this is the most significant development in Queensland he has seen in that time.
Nothing I've done, nothing any government has done, has changed the economic prosperity in the region I grew up like CSG. Nothing. Zero. It's raised standard of living, it's brought kids home that would never have come back to the farm, never have come back to the community as professionals. It has changed, literally changed the world.
Change the world. Good heavens. Can we call it Grangegate?
Grangegate, they're calling it. New South Wales Premier Barry O'Farrell, as we all know, resigned this week for misleading the ICAC corruption inquiry. He denied he had any knowledge of receiving a bottle of 1959 Penfolds Grange Hermitage. Now, a lot of people are asking the question, how could you forget it? But really, was the wine worth the pain? We spoke to Peter Simic, the editor of Wine Estate magazine, and he told us that 1959 wasn't actually a very good year for Grange. He said the vintage was more of a curiosity and a status symbol. He even said it might have had a dead ants character to it. He says Mr. O'Farrell would have been better going for the 1955 or perhaps the 1960 or 1961 vintages. Mr. O'Farrell, of course, doesn't even remember receiving the wine, let alone drinking it. But Mr. Simic says Mr. O'Farrell, had he received it and drank it, should have just sent the wine to the pool room.
It's an extraordinary situation, and I don't remember that something like this has happened before for just a bottle of wine. Look, the 59 is, I think, probably past it. It was a very stalky, dusty, very strong-flavoured wine to start with. And, you know, when you're looking at that kind of an age, I wouldn't have thought it's worth your job.
He got 59 because that was the year he was born.
Yes, and it was supposed to have been worth $3,000. Now, I did notice somewhere selling it for over $4,000 this week, so...
Because of the publicity
has but made Tony, it a more sought-after wine.
The 1960 vintage was far finer the year I was born. Thank you very much, Tony.
Thank you.
Tony Allen with this week's Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
On The Final Cut, an actor who has excelled on stage, screen, and now behind the camera too, Ralph Fiennes, will be in to discuss his new film about Charles Dickens's mistress, sex and celebrity in the Victorian era. Plus, put on your sunglasses at night for Jim Jarmusch's bluesy vampire romance, Only Lovers Left Alive. That's The Final Cut with me, Jason DeRosso, this afternoon after 2.
You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week, all aboard for a steam train ride on the Wilderness Railway in Tasmania's west. Forrest Gump makes an appearance. Well, not the Forrest Gump you might be thinking of. This one's a therapy alpaca. And we travel to the very remote Cameron Corner store, a little dot on the map where the borders of Queensland, New South Wales and South Australia meet.
We've been travelling for a lot of years and been through here a lot, and it got in our blood. And we fell in love with the place. We didn't buy it to be, we knew it wasn't to be millionaires or anything like that. It was purely lifestyle. This place gets in your blood out here in this country.
You'll meet store owner Cheryl Miller a little later on in the program. First, a very special steam train ride in Western Tasmania.
I better jump on so I don't miss the train.
And with a toot and a hiss of steam, we're off. Hello, Margot Foster with you on board a bright green little steam locomotive to travel the West Coast Wilderness Railway in Tasmania's west. Built in 1899, the Apt Railway was a marvel of human engineering for its time. The track was hewn from the wild wilderness to link the copper mining town of Queenstown with Strawn on the coast. In fact, it was the only way in and out of Queenstown for almost 50 years before the roads were built. Today, this historic railway line is a significant tourist attraction for the West Coast communities. It travels through gorgeous, cool, temperate rainforest, past quaint railway sidings, and up and over a mountain using a unique rack and pinion haulage system. So settle back and enjoy the journey.
So there's a bit of tweaking and adjustment all the way. What are you looking out for?
Oh, just watching everything, cars, three-level crosses to cross, just because it's all downhill on the brakes.
It's nice and cosy in the engine room. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Probably one of the warmest spots to be today.
Your job is the fiery today, but you also drive.
Yep.
This is the fire.
Yep.
What do you put in there?
Oil. It's the same way a coal burner does, except we use oil to do it. So it's... lifted in with the steam, made into a gas oil, sprayed around the firebox, and that's there, burns that way.
So that makes it very atmospheric, particularly in the cooler climate, to see all the steam. It looks like a toy train.
From pretty much the bridge back there all the way through, rainforest now.
It's beautiful. I'm seeing vegetation I haven't seen in other parts of Tasmania, for sure.
Yeah, we've got a lot out here, a lot of different types of trees, flowers.
Go ahead,
Tristan.
So do we hop off here? Yep. My name is Troy O'Marney. My role today is fireman on the train.
But you're also a driver sometimes.
I also am a driver sometimes.
You're in a fairly elite group in Australia. There's not many people who get to drive a toy train.
No. I think there's roughly 8 to 10 people in Australia that get paid full-time to drive steam engines. So.
Now, a lot of people who are associated with steam engines have a real love affair with them, and I know there's tremendous interest from volunteer groups and so on, and people can't wait to get their hands on them. Is that something that you have?
I didn't to start with, but it's definitely grown on me over the last 9 years, I think.
And I noticed as we were driving along, you were keeping an eye on gauges and you were tweaking little knobs and levers. Yep. What exactly were you doing?
Oil controls, providing fuel, water for the boiler. The driver does something, the fireman's got to do something to chase him. So.
Right, so you're always a team?
Yep, we spend a lot of time together, so he pays to know what the other one's doing and just keep an eye on him. And like I said, the moment he moves, you've got to move to chase him.
So you can't really take your eye off the ball, can you?
No,
because
no.
Every gauge is telling you something
yep.
significant.
And not only that, you're watching the track at the same time as well, so you get a lot of trees down being in the bush.
There was a lot of tooting along the way. What's
yep.
that about?
Oh, we got 4 level crossings before we leave town, so...
So every level crossing gets a toot?
Whistle twice, yeah.
People must get used to you rumbling by because you set off at 9 o'clock every morning.
Yep.
People could just about set their clocks
yep.
by you.
Yeah, no, I think it's a big thing in the community in Queenstown. Get a lot of people and kids and come out and wave.
How important is it to the town now?
Yeah, no, it is. When they first talked about closing it, it was a big thing in the community with public meetings, and there was a lot of people that wasn't real happy, so I think we got the best result.
Because it's an old fixture in the town, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, like it's been going for 14 years now.
Wasn't the engine at one point in the middle of town?
This one wasn't, but number 3 was, which is back there in the workshop. That was on miner siding since early 70s, I think. So it sat there for 30 years where the mining equipment is.
Wow. And then it was taken out, and that
yeah.
was like a sculpture in the middle of town.
That's it. And now it drives up through the town. So
that's yeah. exciting.
Mm, yeah.
Well, I'm going to go and check out this gold panning business
yep.
around the
no
corner.
No worries at all.
Thanks
Enjoy
very
it.
Much for that, Troy.
No worries.
Well, welcome back on board, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and I hope you enjoyed your time there in Lynchford. Now, did anybody find gold today? Did anyone have a kiss from Lady Luck? No?
No.
No to all of us, it was a slap in the face from Mr. Disappointment. But that is what most of the pandas out here felt. Now, as we pull away from the station, if you are having a look out onto the left-hand side, if you're facing forward, you'll see the Queen River. Now, some of you may have found...
That's amazing. So that guy pops out and does it voluntarily.
Yeah.
Amy, this is a wonderful story, and I can see everybody running to the back to look at that particular rack system. Just explain that again to me.
Well, when it was first brought out to Australia, it had never been tried before. So one of the chief engineers recommended it to the board of directors of Mount Lyell, and he'd heard about it in South America and in Europe. So the director here decided to invest in it. And what you'll have is 2 generic rails, which we have at the moment. So we run on a narrow gauge, which is 3'6". At the moment, we are using this rack and pinion. So you'll find a 3rd toothed rail, which is located in between our standard rails.
And I can feel it sort of hauling
yeah,
us up.
It is. So what it's actually doing is it's working like a haulage, or additionally pulling us up to the top. So
and it's based on a clock.
It is. So you have the cogs, which are located in the engine, or the pinion wheels, and as we come over that rack rail, the teeth in those pinions find their grooves and literally lock into the teeth on that rack rail.
Is this unique in Australia?
It is. We're the only one of its kind in Australia now. There was one up at Mount Morgan, but we're the only one. And we're one of the steepest rack haul, rack and section railways in the southern hemisphere.
And how long's this section?
This is about 2.5 kilometres approximately, and we've got the steepest grades on this section as well. So just near the top, it's about a 1 in 12.
Wow. And how fast are we going?
5 to 10 kilometres, depending on where we are on this part of the track.
Right, so I could jog along.
You could in the earlier days back in the Mount Lyell Railway. A lot of the people, you'd be able to jump off the side, they'd run along. You were never allowed to. For example, we used to have the picnic trains that ran right through to Strawn back in the day. The first one was in 1897, and the last train returning to Queenstown was always known as the Drinker's Special. And a lot of the stories go that the lads whose families, their wives, their partners had already left to go on home, and the men were left to finish the barrels. And the trains were going so slow that they'd jump off and pick a bunch of wildflowers. So by the time they got home, they hopefully wouldn't be in as much trouble.
They're great stories associated around the rail, that's for sure. This is a steep cutting, you know, I can't see the sky.
Yeah, we actually have one of the steepest cuttings in Tasmania for the railways. This one here, when it was put in 1896, was the biggest. It's known as Murray's Cat, and it's about 2.5 stories high and took about 15 weeks to dig out. Wow. Now, when you look at these cuttings, most of them on this section had to be dug out literally by hand. Many of the rocks or the types through here prevented them from using explosives. So if you picture the pickaxe, the old hand drill, that's literally how this railway was built.
And now we're really getting into forest, aren't we?
It's
completely different vegetation now.
It is, and that's the best thing about this railway experience. Is not only do you have the stories, but the scenery changes so much throughout the trip. So this is a cool temperate rainforest that we're travelling through, and you can see that it is quite thick, but it's all regrowth. So when you picture the early surveyors or the men going to Queenstown to work at the mines, and even the railway men, they would have been encountering something that was quite hellish, a bit of a nightmare to all of them. But it was their mottos, like we find a way or we make it, or that determined nature, which is still evident on the West Coast, that helped them go against the odds and make it a success.
What's been the highlight for you so far on the train ride?
To see the driver from the steam train, because in the modern life we don't see the driver of the train and we don't see the engine. Then it was very incredible, yeah.
What are you enjoying so far?
The experience of the olden days, the steam and the sounds and the shuttering, it just brings back a lot of old memories for me, you know, travelling when I was a child on steam trains, yes.
And are you from Tasmania?
No, we're from New South Wales, Sydney, New South Wales.
And you haven't been let down by the train trip?
Oh, no. I'm all into mechanical things, particularly of the past and the achievements that people were able to do in such remote areas. The hard work they put in, the hard labour, and it's still operating now.
So I guess the rack and pinion must have been fantastic to see.
Oh yes, yeah. I haven't seen that before. I've seen other methods of climbing out of valleys and everything with trains, but the rack and pinion, yeah, it's amazing how it's all done.
And the highlight for you?
Oh, the highlight is the enthusiasm of the people that operate it, and the presentation of the carriages and the engine, everything is in such good restoration.
There's a few more surprises to come. I think there's a turntable and the turnaround.
Yeah,
so I'm
looking forward to seeing the changeover at the end of the line.
Hi, Mrs. Delaney.
Hello, Miss Walker. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. You're looking dashing today.
Thank you.
Gorgeous as always.
What are you doing out on our train today?
We're going for a bit of a stroll.
And that was Mrs. Delaney.
That's Mrs. Delaney. She's one of our modern-day station mistresses.
So this is fantastic to be able to get off the train and walk through the forest. This is cool, temperate rainforest.
Yes, and it covers roughly around 10% of the state. And many of the species you'll find here on Western Tasmania actually date back to early Gondwanian times. So they've been relatively unchanged, these species, for about 60 million years. And many of them, like these big ferns here, the Dicksonia antarctica, were here around the time of the dinosaurs. So,
and it is a completely different experience, isn't it? Actually walking through it.
And it helps to put it into perspective for what it would have been like in the early days. They would have had to have slashed their way with the machetes as they made their way through, encountered the leeches all up their legs, wet boots day in, day out, and all their supplies would have been on their back. So you can imagine the physical labour and the wear and tear on their bodies too.
Folks, you're more than welcome to head back across this way.
We've just had a really wonderful part of the tour, doing the little walk in the forest and then seeing the train turn around. I guess this is our last stop before we do head home. How has this journey been different to the previous APT railway journeys?
One of the things that we really wanted to do was add a different twist on the West Coast and the APT Railway. So one of the biggest differences that we have is the story that we tell. So not only do we talk about the APT Railway now and the feats of ingenuity and what they achieved, but we include the West Coast as a whole. So the rival railways, the feud of our two hot-headed Irishmen that came here,
one of which was behind the Apt Railway, and another one which was behind another equally as important railway which shaped the West Coast. So our aim, I guess, at the end of it was for people to get off the journey, have, wow, this could have been so different once upon a time. Queenstown could have been ruins, for example. So when they go off, they might want to go and explore other regional areas. So we have that economic development and we're assisting other towns, not so much Queenstown and only Strawn, which is what it used to be. But you can get a taste of what the West Coast is from the railway. And when you go away to the other areas, it's all connected and it helps to put it all together and you get that great sense of community and the message of the triumphant people of the West.
Amy Walker from the West Coast Wilderness Railway, ending that special report from Margot Foster in Queenstown in Western Tasmania. And there are some beautiful photographs from that trip on our website. Check it out at abc.net.au/rural. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, running the store at Cameron Corner and love alpaca style.
Forrest, 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 come on, here, son. Always call him son, because he is, hey?
You can't miss Niels Lansky, especially when Forrest Gump is with him. Hello, I'm Lucy Barber, with you on the streets of Hall, just outside Canberra in the Australian Capital Territory. Now, this Forrest Gump isn't the Forrest Gump you might be thinking of. He's a lapaca, three quarters llama, one quarter alpaca, and he's very cute. They're generally used as guardian animals to protect sheep and lambs from wild dog attacks. But Forrest Gump here has a much softer side. He's a therapy animal, providing comfort to sick and elderly people in hospices and nursing homes.
I got him when he was 2 months old. He had a collapsed lung and severe heat stroke, and the owner thought he was going to die, and I gave him lots of massage with essential oils, and he came good, and so the owner gave him to me because she knew I'd use him for therapy work, and so he goes to the hospice and nursing homes, and he's been at Cranley School and a couple of visits with him.
He's incredibly friendly. In fact, he's just wrapped his lead around me and he's snuggling up at my side. He's so cute. That is his big draw card, isn't it? His friendly nature.
Yeah, I had him at a nursing home at Jamison the other day, and he went around and kissed all the old people. And a friend of mine's there in end-stage cancer, and she was separate, and he'd never met her. But he went up to her, and he snuggled her face and kept coming back to her, and he talked to her, and he goes, how they hum. That's their communication. And he just kept doing it, and she texted me later, and she said, do you think he knows that I'm on the way out? And he did know. But he sort of confirmed to me that he had what my other therapy alpacas had, the ability to empathise with people and understand what they're going through and give them some extra TLC.
So what made you want to get into doing that sort of thing?
1995, I did a hospice and palliative care volunteers course at the old Royal Canberra. And one of the patients here was blind. She had a brain tumour. And one day I borrowed a baby rabbit from a pet shop and took it in and just put it on her chest and lifted a hand up and put it on the baby rabbit. And the look on her face was just unbelievable. There's a couple of Latin words, and I don't know how to pronounce it, but noblesse oblige or something like that. But basically it means if you're fortunate, share it round. Come on. Come on, darling.
Hello, darling. How are you? Hey? Oh, I love animals. Sorry. Don't I, Nils?
Yeah. He's found a dog. He loves dogs. He met a Great Dane at the Hall Markets one day. They got on like a house on fire, you know, old mates we sniffed each other's butts, you know, like dogs do. Hey, he just forgot he was a lapaca, didn't you? Hey?
Now, these creatures are often known to spit. Does Forrest Gump do that?
He doesn't do it very often.
Hopefully not on the patients.
No, he's never spat at a stranger. They only spit when they're really annoyed. You know, it's like if you're driving and somebody cuts you off and you give them the middle finger. Well, they can't give the paw, so they spit, you know. No, I haven't really seen him really cranky. Alpacas and llamas are probably the most naturally protective animals on earth. They've got this instinct to want to protect anything they consider vulnerable, sometimes to lie down next to a patient's bed. And that was telling the world that if anybody wanted to hurt that patient, they had to cross him first, because that's exactly what he did when I brought home 1 and 2 day old lambs.
Have you got any funny stories of Forrest Gump?
One day you'll get me into trouble with the police. A lot of people know that I used to drive around with Honeycomb in the back seat of the Mazda 121, and he had his head right out the window, and we got away with that for years until a young policewoman put a stop to it, which is perfectly legal because what we were doing was highly illegal.
And Honeycomb being the other, the older alpaca. Yeah.
And sometimes Forrest Gump slides the window of the van open with his nose and sticks his head right out, which I'm just waiting for a member of the constabulary to give me a caution.
We've been travelling for a lot of years and been through here a lot, and it got in our blood, and we fell in love with the place. We didn't buy it to be, we knew it wasn't to be millionaires or anything like that. It was purely lifestyle. This place gets in your blood out here in this country.
And you'd have to love this landscape if you were prepared to swap life in lush tropical North Queensland for a remote speck of land in the Australian outback. Hello, I'm Cherie McDonald, and when I say remote, I mean remote. Cheryl Miller and her husband Fenn run the store at Cameron Corner, a dot on the map where the borders of Queensland, New South Wales and South Australia meet. Cheryl admits it's a harsh climate and a world away from the Great Barrier Reef and the rainforests they left behind in Port Douglas.
Well, usually the first question is, how long have you been here? And when they find out where we're originally from, they say, my God, what are you doing here?
Now, the history of this corner store, how come it's here?
An ex-Vietnam vet by the name of Sandy Knoll came out here and camped on the sand dune near the post for a few weeks and counted cars. And he decided he could start a business here. He was a bit of a mechanic. And he approached a couple of the properties, and Queensland was the first to come through with 1 square mile. We're on 640 acres. He started it and was just a tiny little house, tiny little store to start with, and there's a memorial under the flagpole to him. 1989, the land was sectioned off and started, but the store itself was actually put in 1990. So we're planning on a big celebration in 2015 for 25 years.
Now, on the wall behind you, there are a couple of photographs of Black Hawk helicopters. What was going on there?
A couple of years ago, when the rain was really up, and we had about 20 bike riders here for lunch, and I'm cooking hell for leather at the grill plate, and the next thing we heard this, woo, 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 woo. Thought, gee, that's a big helicopter. And then heard another one, and we thought they were only going to do a passover, but no, they just dropped down in the paddock and all came in for lunch. And they were great guys. They were on their way from Townsville to Woomera. So, yeah, well, you never know what's going to come here next.
So how often does that kind of thing happen?
Oh, every week there's something new. We had a big group of sidecars here. We have tractors. We've had a fellow on a ride-on mower all the way from Bourke. We have cyclists. We have walkers. We have people being pulled by camels. We have all sorts of things. And, of course, you get the planes and the vintage cars.
Where do some of your tourists come from?
All parts of Australia and Germany, France, Japan, Korea. The other day we had 5 Russians.
How do you manage making sure that the taps don't run dry for beer, that you've got enough food here to feed the masses when they do arrive?
I think it helps us being from tropical North Queensland. We used to, before every wet season, get all the supplies in case you get cut off. All the supplies come from Broken Hill and on the mail, so you've just got to be organised.
You can't help but look up when you step inside the store. There, up on the ceiling, are lots of $5 notes, and by all accounts, it's not easy getting them to stick. Here's Cheryl again.
If anyone bush camps here, we don't ask money for ourselves, because as far as we're concerned, if you bush camp in Australia, you shouldn't really pay. So we just ask a $5 donation per vehicle to the Flying Doctors.
Trying to stick it onto the ceiling because all donations go to the Flying Doctors.
How long have you been trying to do that this afternoon?
Third time.
Explain how you've wrapped this $5 note up.
It's a thumbtack with a 20-cent coin wrapped up in the $5 note.
Okay, that's the fourth time. So what's the theory behind the technique on being able to make it stay up there? Well, have you got any tips from those who have succeeded before?
Don't look up and don't do it hard.
Oh! So where have you been travelling? How did you find yourself in Camera Corner?
I first went to Victoria, Meambulla, Craig's Hut, then just travelled all the way up to here through Broken Hill, checked out Silverton, then just here and doing anything I find interesting.
So have you been into this area before?
No, first time.
How are you travelling?
By four-wheel drive, just using my swag. And
you know, you said you're from Wollongong, so how are you finding it so far coming out in bush?
Good, quiet, relaxing, the friendly people, the views and, yeah, just relaxation.
Outback traveller David Kennedy ending that report from Cherie McDonald at the Cameron Corner store. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. I'm Libby Price. Coming up, a leading agricultural scientist says he's deeply disappointed with the lack of science policy and investment by the Abbott government.
We hope you're enjoying all the Easter holiday listening here on RN. To cap it off, Monday morning, join me, James Carlton. We're taking you back to 1964, the Beatles' tour of Australia, the year the Lucky Country became a surprise bestseller, the Australian newspaper first hit the streets, and this man disembarked on our shores.
The thing that really staggered me was how few different nationalities there were.
1964 Revisited, an Easter Monday special from 6, here on RN.
Australia needs a long-term policy and vision if it's to fully capitalise on the growth of Asia's middle class. And that's going to require renewed investment in agriculture from both government and industry to the tune of $100 billion. That's the key finding of a report by the Australian Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering. Now, rather ironically, that report was launched this week at the same time as news of another 300 job cuts at the CSIRO and federal government budget cuts to science by as much as $2 billion. I spoke to Professor Snow Barlow after the launch of the report, Green Growth, Food and Fibre.
We wonder about the commitment of this government to science. There is no science minister for the first time for quite a while. We also know that the Prime Minister's Science, Technology and Innovation Council, which usually meets twice to three times a year, has not met in this government as yet. Sure, you know, we have a budget problem. And of course, all sectors of the community need to contribute to doing something about that. What we're talking about is where Australia's standard of living may be in the next 30 years. You know, post-mining boom, what are we going to depend on?
And you're pushing agriculture. You call for a national, multi-decade, bipartisan approach.
Challenging.
Yes. I was going to say nothing like asking for the near impossible.
Well, why should it be? You know, it was very interesting. Brian Smith, the Nobel laureate in astrophysics, wrote a piece around how Australian science policy wobbles all the time and go from one policy to another with successive government. And top quality scientists can't cope with that in the sense where you recruit very good people and then they don't have any funding and they leave. His key statement in that was by far the best thing we could do would be to stay with some policy for a decade, and that would be the biggest return we could get. So I'm really asking for something like that.
How critical to that is the CSIRO? They've cut another 300 jobs, so that's 700 that have gone in the last 12 months. There are reports their budget is going to be cut by as much as $20 million. Is it possible to keep cutting at the CSIRO and perhaps refocus what they're doing to make it more critical to this food future that you talk about?
That's a challenge. That's a big challenge for them. You know, CSIRO is important. CSIRO is our national research organisation. And while state departments, while universities make very big contributions to agriculturalist workers as well, CSIRO is the body that is able to mount big groups of people to look at important issues. We hope that they don't get cut any further, but also we hope that the rural food agricultural area and CSIRO isn't cut as part of this current cut, because it has declined within CSIRO quite considerably over the last 20 years as other sectors have become more important.
And if it does get cuts to agricultural science?
It just means that we might miss out on what is a sort of a once in half a century opportunity in some ways, this Asian dining boom. You know, we've been through a time of fairly declining terms of trade in the 80s, 90s and the noughties essentially. But suddenly, if we look in the last 7 years, the FAO food price index has doubled and then settled down at something like is about 70% what it was in a decade ago. So the opportunity is there. Now, are we going to grasp that? And it's not as though there aren't competitors. You know, New Zealand is probably doing better than we are at present. They've got their act very much together. Brazil is a big competitor. The US is a big competitor. And Canada is a big competitor. So just because we're on the bottom of Asia doesn't really give us a big comparative advantage. But what will give us a comparative advantage, if we leverage off our reputation for actually producing quality food, producing safe food and producing something that is traceable, so the middle classes of Asia know that when they buy Australian, and that's the brand Australian, they are getting something that they can depend on.
We're all getting a little closer to retirement, and I wonder, as a scientist of some renown, if you feel that it's ever been this bad as far as a recognition of an investment in science by government.
Well, it's early days in this government yet. It's the first budget. You know, we have been through, as I say to my students, some dark tunnels. We are not seeing very much encouragement for the sector to hang in there, and hopefully there will be better times. We haven't heard much about a science policy at all, haven't heard much about an innovation policy. So we're wondering what we're doing all this science for.
Professor Snow Barlow from the University of Melbourne. Prince William, the Duke of Cambridge, and his wife Catherine, Duchess of Cambridge, were taken on a short tour of the Sydney Royal Easter Show yesterday. Neville Russell is a long-standing committee member of the Royal Agricultural Society of New South Wales. He told Sally Bryant he vividly remembers the previous royal visit to the Sydney show. He was given the honour of taking care of the Princess Royal, Princess Anne, during her tour in 1988. And he says the royal visit this year is going to be a real showstopper.
It sure is, yes. But I can remember back in 1988 meeting and privileged to look after Her Royal Highness Princess Anne while we were conducting the dairy interbreed competition. And I looked after her probably 45 minutes or a little bit longer.
Wow, what an experience. So how did it work? What were your jobs?
Well, first of all, I've been part of the cattle committee, and the dairy section is a great part of the cattle committee. With our dairy cows, we have a culmination, which we call the dairy interbreed, and the winners from quite a lot of the classes in the six dairy breeds compete for the grand final, as it were, for the supreme animal.
So that was what you were involved in when the Princess Royal came to the show?
That's correct, yes. I was chairman of the dairy subcommittee at that time, and the chairman of the cattle committee, Trevor Smith, asked me if I would be prepared to look after Princess Anne at that time. And I had to give them a running itinerary of times and what we do, how we addressed her and that sort of thing. And the day came when, nervously, Trevor Schmidt, the chairman of the cattle committee, was introduced to Princess Anne and brought her along to meet me as chairman of the dairy people.
And you spent, you say, about 45 minutes with her. What were the topics of conversation?
There had been the first of our competitions run, which was the pen of five animals from the six dairy breeds. And a plaque had just been presented to the winner of the Holstein breed, to the president. And He was holding that, and I introduced Princess Anne to him. And she looked at the plaque and said, "You haven't run it all the time. There's a lot of the Jersey little plaques on this." And, of course, she was very pro-Jersey. But then I introduced her to each one of the dairy presidents. She had a one-on-one conversation for probably a minute with each one and really made them feel at home.
And it sounds very much as though the Princess Royal had a fair handle on the whole dairy industry.
Very much so. She... Following that, we sat down and talked. She understood the feeding of dairy cows and all that. She said that Holstein cows were too big. She'd prefer the Windsor Jerseys much more. But we discussed breeding and artificial insemination, feeding of cattle and that sort of thing.
Now, have you been given the nod to do any squiring of Prince William when he's here?
No, I'm keeping away from that. There are a lot of more important people than me to do that.
It's quite an exciting thing for the show, for the Prince and for the Duchess to be coming?
It's very much so, and it becomes a royal show now.
So is it creating a different vibe in the show this year, do you think?
Well, I would hope so. I know it's going to be a very, very short visit, which is so disappointing, but and there'll be very few people be able to see them but not speak to them, because I think they come in for an hour or so and then they go again.
Neville Russell, long-standing committee member of the Royal Agricultural Society of New South Wales. Now, animal lovers tend to get rather too carried away with anthropomorphising their pets. New Zealand comedians Amelia Guild and Emma Newborn have turned that very concept of giving animals human characteristics into a show called The Bitch's Box. Set on the windswept plains of New Zealand's South Island, the stars of the show are two bitches, that is, female sheepdogs, Red and Twink, who are on heat and therefore locked in the infamous Bitch's Box. The short play is currently running at the Melbourne Comedy Festival before touring regional New South Wales. Amelia and Emma escaped the box to come into the ABC studios to talk about the play.
We wanted to write a play, and we wanted to depict life on the farm through the eyes of the dogs, and that's not always fun and laughter and games. They're hard workers and stuff goes wrong, and yeah.
Now, it is very much about farm life. I had the vision of a windswept sheep farm. Good. On the South Island of New Zealand.
That's what we wanted.
Are you both from a farm?
I am, but no, Emma is an Auckland girl.
Yeah, born and bred city. I'd never even been on a farm until 2.5 years ago.
Because it really captures what it is in a dog's brain to muster sheep. Did you kind of get it to start off with?
Yeah, I went, well, the first time I went to a farm, I woke up at 5 a.m. with Amelia, and we went out into the back blocks of her station and did a muster, basically, and it was amazing. And I was like, you know, sort of crouching behind the scrub with the scrim. And
it was funny. It was we really were just helping my brother, who was there trying to do his best sort of shepherd show with all his dogs. I'll show you, Emma, how you muster a mob of sheep and lambs and get them in. And then they had the classic lamb break that was not meant to happen at all, but you know, you've got farmers stomping on hats and dogs just having a hell of a good time.
Because you have the lamb break, which is when the lambs break away from the mob.
Yeah,
and you have that in the show. Yeah. And the dogs love that.
Absolutely love it.
But don't chew
thing.
On the ewe.
yeah.
Like that. Tell us about the two main characters, Red and Twink.
Twink is the young pup who's getting put into the box for the first time. And yeah, Emma plays Red, the old, the wise old bitch who's been on a few heats, knows what that's all about, get locked in the box and you're there for a good couple of weeks.
And has had her heart broken by the house dog.
Yeah, she's been around the yard a few times. She knows, you know, she's sort of slightly world weary, but I think it by the end is still learning off the young pup as much, you know. It's actually a really nice relationship between the two of them by the end.
And we have a new house dog who is a bit of a rapper.
I mean, this is absolutely modelled on my parents' black Labrador. He's desperately uncool, but he wants to be part of, you know, part of the groove on the farm with all the farm dogs. And he has all the perks of, you know, the house dog. So he gets way too much food, way too much freedom.
Gets a little excited and wheezes in the house.
Totally. But he's just got no respect from the rest of the team. You know, they've got their own little pack thing going on in the hierarchy, and we just thought, why not completely throw it on its head and have him trying to rap to woo them.
And he thinks he's really cool when he rolls in a cow pat. I thought that was rather delightful as well. Definitely house dog stuff.
You've seen that, though, haven't you, when dogs, they've rolled in something horrific and they just feel quite, they're all proud. You know,
they can't understand why they're in trouble. And I think the pièce de résistance, I have to say, is the retired pig hunter, was he?
Yeah, the pig hunting
dog. What's his name again?
His name is James Clive Reginald Montgomery Smith.
Quintessential retired British Army officer in a pig hunting dog with an eye patch and an extraordinary dribble. How do you dribble like that?
It's actually very easy. You just, if you talk out the side of your mouth, it sort of naturally happens. The spit just falls out.
Now, I don't really need the spit, but could we hear a little bit of him?
Yeah, absolutely.
Soldiers, dogs of the pig, my brothers, I am James Clive Reginald Montgomery Smith of the fourth kennel in the line of kennels under the self-seeded 75-year-old Norfolk Pine.
Wonderful. And you did it without the dribble. I'm very pleased. Perhaps we could hear a little bit of Twink. Or how about when Twink is talking about which dog she might like to mate with?
I wonder what Steve's doing. I wonder what Max is doing. Oh, I wonder what Please is doing. Hey, he's probably penning up that or working the race. Not us, though. We just get to relax. Chill out. Hang loose. Rest, recover, recoup.
Very cute. It is brave of you to bring this to the Melbourne Comedy Festival. I understand you are going to regional New South Wales afterwards, but to be honest with you, we're so much more urbanised in Australia than in New Zealand. I wonder perhaps if the average Melbourne person doesn't have the reference points, doesn't really quite get the whole farm dog thing.
I think that's... a really interesting thing for us. We took it to Edinburgh and we had a similar sort of, you know, it was very much a big city. People still engage with it, and I think it's because they're learning about a world or getting a window into a world that they don't know. And people still know dogs, so they can attach to that, you know, and recognise their things and their own dogs at home. But in terms of the farming, yeah, I like to think that we are, you know, giving them something to think about or learn about.
And what's next for you? Where do you go next with the Bitches Box?
The Bitches Box. We, New South Wales rural tour planned, actually. We've got, we normally in New Zealand perform in woolsheds. We've done about 50-odd woolsheds around the country. And we're taking this to New South Wales. So we're starting at Old Aronbang Woolshed, which is beautiful old 40-something stand shed. You know, quite a historic place, and we're doing three shows there near Orange, and then heading up to Mudgee and doing some shows there. So,
oh, well, best of luck with it. I reckon that's the place it should be, in a woolshed. It'd just be wonderful because you get that smell as well.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Yeah. Amelia Guild and Emma Newborn, who wrote and now act in the short comedic play The Bitches Box, which is showing at the Melbourne Comedy Festival and then goes on tour around regional New South Wales. And that's all we have time for today. If you'd like to look at some of the photographs taken for today's stories, perhaps just read some more of the news or listen back to a podcast, you can do all of that simply by heading to our website, abc.net.au/rural. Great to have your company this morning, and thanks to our technical producer, John Jacobs. On RN, my name's Libby Price. I'll talk to you next week on A Country Breakfast.